We've been working through Luke's Gospel, and we come to this section in chapter 9, which gives answer to the question of what is a Christian. It's a funny kind of question because it's so easy to assume that you know the answer. Indeed, it's so easy to assume that you know the answer that quite often you never even bother asking the question. I grew up in Bellevue Hill, that fine part of Sydney. I didn't like the fact that only Sydney people were materialists. And I knew what a Christian was from my childhood. It was anybody who wasn't Jewish. They had public holidays and certain times of the year, and we had Santa Claus. It was very simple what is a Christian when you live in the Jewish part of town. And it wasn't until I discovered that I wasn't a Christian that I ever became one. But the discovery that I wasn't one was almost bigger than the discovery of becoming one. I discovered I wasn't one because my brother told me he wasn't. And I knew he wasn't Jewish. So there you go. What is a Christian? It's a fairly important subject to get right, isn't it? The best way is to find what is it that Jesus demands of people. I can tell you what this brand name of Christianity demands of you. I can tell you what that brand name of Christianity demands of you. But that's not in the end what's important. It's what does Jesus demand of you? That's the important part. What are the authentic demands of Jesus? And the place in the Bible where he does it, where he actually tells people what is demanded of them to be his followers, is Luke chapter 9. And that is why we raise the subject tonight. You can find other parallel places, of course, but here is one very clear place where he makes his demands upon his followers. And you can see that he is speaking in general terms. For in verse 23, if you look actually in the inside of the green sheets, you'll notice the Bible passage is written on the left-hand side. And those numbers that scatter down from 18 through to 26 are the verse numbers to which I refer. And the last paragraph, you see, starts with verse 23. In verse 23, he said to them all, that is all his disciples who are around gathered with him at the time, he said to them all, if anyone would come after me, it's a very general statement, isn't it? Anyone, whoever they may be, if you wish to come after me, you must. The anyone makes it open to all, the must makes it very exclusive. This is what is required to be one who comes after Jesus. To be a follower of Jesus, this is what is demanded of you. Whoever you may be, the general term, speaking to all his disciples, the authentic demands of Jesus. What are they? Well, you see them there in verse 23. They're threefold. If any man would come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross daily, follow me. There are the three things that Jesus asks, indeed demands, that anyone who would be a Jesus person must deny themselves, take up the cross, follow me. And those three actually roll up into one in the next verse. For in the next verse he says, for whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me will save it. Those three things, to deny yourself, take up the cross daily and follow me, is really to lose your life for my sake. Look at them in turn and we'll see that that's what it boils down to. To deny himself is a strange phrase, isn't it? You kind of expect him to add something more to the phrase, don't you? Deny himself an ice cream. Deny himself a motor car. Deny himself a colour TV. Deny himself a something you're expecting, but he doesn't. He just says, deny himself. And that is the end of it. To deny is to say no. You make an accusation against me and I deny it. I say no, that's not true. I deny myself a Weight Watchers program. I've actually said no, I'm going to be fat and enjoy myself. I've said no. Whatever deny it means to say no. What have I got to say no to what have I got to say no to? Jesus says, you must say no to yourself.
That is what you need to say no to.
No to your own government, to your own self-centeredness, to your own self-rule, to doing your own thing your own way, running your own life as if God wasn't there, ignoring him, possibly actively rebellious against him, but doing yourself, doing your own, being the boss. The first step is to give up yourself. For many people, that in itself is too much. I mean, if he said to give up cigarettes, I'd give it a try. If he said to give up milkshakes, I'd give it a try. If he said for 40 days in Lent, I had to give up fish, I'd give it a try. Especially if I don't like them. But when he starts saying, I've got to give up myself, he's asking too much. And for many of us, of course, are less honest. And we say, sure, I can do that. But we really wish to shortchange him. So just provided he doesn't ask me to give up something, or something else, or the boyfriend, or the career, or the... Provided I can hang on to some little bit myself, well then I'm happy to give up myself. But his demand is very absolute. He must deny himself and take up his cross daily. Crucifixion was commonly practiced in the time of Jesus. Many thousands were killed publicly that way by the Romans. And those who were crucified had to carry the cross piece of the cross out to the place of execution. The carrying of the cross piece of the cross was a declaration that you were the condemned man. And by Jewish law of the first century, as best we understand it, it would seem that you had already been declared dead. So that those who were seen carrying the cross had no rights, no civil liberties left. And as they were walking along with the soldiers around them carrying their cross piece, the crowd would gather around and taunt them and whip them and spit upon them and to buffet them. It was like the medieval stocks, where people could gather around and make fun and torment people. I understand that one of the medieval colleges of our University of New South Wales has a set of stocks. Well, it could not be a new college, could it? Some of them you have to work at, don't you? And the whole exercise of putting a person in the stocks was to make their life misery for some short period of time. Well, so was the man who carried his cross. His life was a misery, and it is recorded that many a man was glad to arrive at the place of execution for the things the crowd had done to him on the way. Jesus takes this real life practice, familiar to his hearers, and says, if you're going to be my disciple, if you're going to follow me, then you must say no to your own self-government, and you must take up your cross. You must play the role of the man already condemned to death, and publicly open yourself to the abuse of following one who is Jesus. Daily, it goes on. For that man is a strange one, isn't he? He is dead already, though he walks on alive to his death. And that is what the follower of Jesus must be, one who has already died to himself, died publicly so that people will now turn against him, and yet still goes on daily living until his final death. The rest of his short life is open to the shame and abuse of being one of those Christian twits. So far, the demands of Jesus sound like a massacre society. Anyone who hates himself, and anybody who likes being unpopular, feel free to join. It sounds like a massacre society. But there is no value in self-denial in itself. Indeed, God has given us a beautiful world to enjoy. And there is no value in being persecuted of itself. No, the value in it lies in the last of the third commands. Take up your cross daily and follow me. There is the value in it. For it's not purposeless suffering. It's not mindless masochism. It's to commit my life completely to Jesus. To go where he goes and to do what he does. And to accept his lead in everything, wherever it may take me, and under any circumstances. And so you see, the three things actually roll into the one. To lose my life for him. The demands of Jesus is total commitment to him. Here then is what a Christian is. A Christian is not someone who's been baptized. All kinds of pagans have been baptized, and I know many a Christian who hasn't. A Christian is not one who's a churchgoer. All kinds of pagans go to churches. All kinds of pagans run churches. That doesn't make a Christian. A Christian is not one who's an Australian. That's not hard to work out. A Christian is not one who is a good, moral, upright person. There are many a Jewish friend that I grew up with who is very good, moral and upright and would be deeply offended to be called a Christian. Those are not what Christian is. A Christian is one who is totally committed to Jesus, who has given up running his own life, given up self-government, in order to live and die under Jesus' government. That is what a Christian is. A Jesus person. A Christ person. But when you hear the demands of Jesus, especially if they're new to you, you should actually scratch your head and say, well, look, who on earth does he think he is? I mean, if I said to you, my friends, look, I will give to you eternal life. All you need to do is give up everything and come follow me. You say, look, I always knew he was a bit megalomaniac, but this is absurd. He has finally done the trick. Should we just try and sneak him out privately somewhere? I mean, that is an absurd thing to ask of people, isn't it? It almost sounds an immoral thing to ask of people. Give up everything. Not just some, but all that you are. Give it all away. Declare yourself as if dead and suffer the consequences. And come, follow me. That is more than any man can reasonably ask of any man. So who on earth does he think he is? It's in the question, in the context of who Jesus thinks he is, that he makes those demands. But you'll notice back in verse 18, he has got with his disciples and he says, all right, who do people say that I am? Who do the crowds think I am? And there's all kinds of answers come out. They say some think you're John the Baptist, come back from the dead. Others think you're Elijah. Some think you're one of the prophets of old. They're really first century Jewish answers. If we know our first century Judaism, if we know our New Testament, our Old Testament, we'll know that they're very good answers for that day and age. Elijah, for example, was prophesied to come again before the great kingdom of God. And so the people were looking for Elijah to come, and here is somebody who does the kinds of things Elijah does. And so maybe this is the Elijah. Very good answers for that period of time, that culture. But I guess they're not today's answers. Today's answers are different. If we should do a survey of public opinion around about us, we'd find that very few people would opt for Elijah. Not many would go for John the Baptist. We did a survey earlier this year down at New South Wales University. We actually interviewed some 800 students. And one of the questions we asked them was who they thought Jesus was. 8% said he was a teacher. Another 11% said he was a philosopher. Another 6% went for one of the old-fashioned answers. He was a prophet. Some 4% said he was a church founder. 7% said they didn't know. And then there was a whole bunch of them that we couldn't classify under one title or another because there were just so many kind of different answers. So there were some 16% who we put down as saying he was another. All kinds of answers that people give. All kinds of ideas as to who Jesus could be. Who Jesus was and who Jesus is. Who do men say that I am? Who do the crowds think I am? But that's an academic question. Jesus changes it radically and dramatically in verse 20. But what about you? Who do you say that I am? Now, that's a different question altogether, isn't it? I mean, if I say to you, who did the people of New South Wales vote for at the last state elections? You'll say, Rand's our man. Or Rand, worse luck. But you'll be able to say Rand without any great difficulty. As an objective fact, that is who the people voted for. Let me ask you another question. Who did you vote for? Now the answer to that's simple, isn't it? None of your business. It's a completely different question, isn't it? Because I'm now not asking anything academic and detached and objective about life, I'm now asking something about you when I pose that question. So who do people say Jesus is? Oh, some say he's a prophet, some say he's a teacher, a founder of a world religion, blah, blah, blah. There's all kinds of options. But that's not the question he puts, you see. He says, all right, but who do you say that I am? And Peter, for the first time, says, you are the Christ. The Christ of God. It's a technical term, Christ. It's the term Messiah. For God had promised that he was to send a king who would rule through Israel the whole world forever. He would establish his kingdom. His kingdom would be over all the world and it would go on forever. And it would be established through a man who is to be the Messiah, the Christ. And Peter and the disciples had come at this point to perceive that Jesus was that one who had been prophesied for centuries, the Messiah, the Christ of God, the one who comes to establish the very kingdom of God, to rule over all the world forever, living in the Roman Empire. And being a zealous Israelite, there is little doubt what that meant to Peter and to the disciples. Here at last, the power of Israel was going to rise up and overthrow the empire that had held them in captivity for many, many years. Here now was Israel's great day of glory about to dawn. Jerusalem, not Rome, would be the world capital. Now all the nations who had so trodden us underfoot for thousands of years were going to have their comeuppance. Now they were going to be put in their place. Now our king was going to be king. This man who stood before them with neither sword nor knife, who stood as a teacher. Jesus accepts the view of the disciples in verse 21, but hushes them up about it. It's a long story why he hushed them up about it, and as you come week by week you can hear about that. He didn't want them to tip their hand, is the quick answer. He had a particular plan in purpose, and if they go around saying all the things they think at the moment, they'll botch up the story completely. And so although they've got the right answer, he wants them to keep it quiet for a moment because actually they've got the wrong answer. They've got the right label. Yes, he's the Christ. They've got the wrong product. He's not the Christ like they're expecting. He's quite a different kind of Christ. And so he says, I'm the Son of Man. It's a favourite phrase of his. He uses it himself. No one else uses it in the Gospel accounts. It was just one of those unusual things that Jesus used. But it comes out of the passage we read as our Old Testament lesson in Daniel chapter 7. Because in Daniel chapter 7, God said that at the great time of judgment, when the books were opened and all the world brought into accountability, one like the Son of Man would come in the clouds, and to him would be given all authority, all power, to rule over all nations for all time. Jesus says, keep quiet about the Christ. Yes, that's who I am. And I am the Son of Man. I will come in the glory of the Father and the glorious angels. That fits, Peter says, yes, you're the Christ, the Son of Man, the ruler of the world. That is what I believe. That's what I'm saying. But that's not what Jesus is saying. Verse 22. And he said, the Son of Man must suffer many things, be rejected by the elders, chief priests, teachers of the law, be killed. Can't be so. How can you come as the ruler of the world and be rejected by the people of Israel? It's from Israel that you are to rule. How can you be the ruler of the universe and be killed? How can you rule the world forever and die? Jesus says he must be killed and on the third day raised to life. Well, yes, Peter would believe in the resurrection. On the last day, everyone will be raised to life. He's no doubt about that, but how can Jesus be the king of the universe and be killed? But Jesus didn't mean that. Jesus said he will be raised to life after 3 days. Jesus' view gives a very strange twist to the Messiah, for he says that it was necessary for him to die. Yet Jesus understood that he was the ruler of the world. And Jesus understood he was going to be the judge of the world. For notice what he says in the last of our verses there, verse 26. If anyone is ashamed of me and of my words, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his glory and in the glory of the Father and of the holy angels. Jesus saw himself as the one who had come in all glory to judge the world. And if men were ashamed of him now, he would be ashamed of them then. If you lose your life now for my sake, you will save it. He is the giver of life and the taker of life. He is the judge of the nations. Now he perceives himself to be the Messiah, all right, to be the Son of God, Son of Man. But to come to his kingdom in a completely different way. We, of course, have got tremendous advantage over the disciples at this point. For many of us will know the rest of the story. We know that he did die in order to bring his kingdom in. And his conquest was not over Rome, but over a much greater empire than Rome, over all the forces of evil in mankind and in this universe. For he died as punishment for our sins, and he rose again, vindicated by God, conquering death, the great sentence that hangs before us all. If he had conquered Rome, then it wouldn't have helped the Australians very much. It certainly would have changed human history, and so we don't know where we'd be now. But empires come and empires go, don't they? One after another after another. That's not the one he conquered. The one he conquered is the one that you and I were born into. That is, into the empire of darkness, of sin, of death. We all know we're going to die. And we all know that that is in itself an obscene thing. It's a terrible thing that a life should suddenly be taken. But we all should know also that we sin. Each and every one of us. And we turn over new leaves and we turn them over and we turn them over, don't we? I'm not going to be jealous again. I'm not going to be envious like that. I shouldn't say those kind of catty things. I'm sorry about stretching the truth like I did. Why am I so concerned to be impressive to other people? Why did I... I won't go on. You know your problem. And you know they don't really get better from year to year either. They just change sometimes. No one teaches you to do the wrong thing. You can manage it by yourself, can't you? You do not need to teach your children to do the wrong thing either. They will manage it by themselves. It is part of the dominion of darkness that we live in this world, whereby this world will never get better. But Jesus conquers it. Jesus overcomes the evil one. He pays the penalty for people who have rebelled against God, such as we have. And he overcomes the sentence that waits for us all, namely death, by coming to new life again. We understand that the fight he is fighting is completely different to the fight Peter was expecting. The world ruler indeed, who must die. And so he demands of his disciples total commitment to him, he who will come in all the glory as the world ruler. But why such demands? Why go to such lengths? Couldn't he have just said, well, look, be good, children, be good? It depends on who you think Jesus is, as to why he makes the demands that he makes. And so now I turn that question back to you, as Jesus turned the question back to the disciples. Who do you think Jesus is? You may say, well, look, I really don't know. Some 7 or so% of our little survey, that's what their conclusion was. And that may be the position you're in at the moment. You don't know. You've not looked at the evidence about Jesus and can come to really no conclusion.
We found in our survey that some 46% of the uni students we interviewed had not read the New Testament. Another 24% of them had only read part of it. They're not in a very much of a position to know about Jesus, to make any decision as to who he is, and whether his claims are believable, whether his claims are true. If that is the category you're in at the moment, then I encourage you to find out about him. And one of the great reasons is because the claims that he is making is that he owns you, he rules you, he is going to judge you, and the way you treat him will be the way you will be treated for eternity. Now, if that's true, ignorance is not much help, is it? It's worth pursuing to find out that it's false, rather than to remain ignorant. How? Well, there's lots of ways. Keep coming and listening to the Bible expounded week by week. We have a bookstall up there at that end of the church, and there's an excellent little book on it called Basic Christianity, and that sounds to me the place where you need to start. Basic Christianity by John Stott. If you haven't got the money to buy it tonight, we'll just take it from the shelf. Happy about that. If people are concerned to find out more, then that amount of money we lose is nothing. Absolutely nothing. You can afford it, well and good. Basic Christianity is up there. I've got several copies of it. If you'd like to investigate the claims of Jesus further, then with the visitor's card that you find around at the end of the chairs there, if you care to put your name and address and put a tick on it, we'll interpret that to mean that you'd like to come and do a little investigative Bible study with us, or like us to come to you and do it. Some of our staff here have drawn up 4 studies, 1-hour studies, and we'd be very happy to go to anybody's home and to sit with them at their convenience and go through those 4 studies with them. Do it privately. We won't pester you. We won't be ringing you up for months and months afterwards or anything like that. We'll stick to our contract. We'll come to you at your convenience for 4 1-hour sessions to investigate those claims. If you'd like to find out more, all you need to do is put your name and address, telephone number, and tick that card anywhere on the card, and we'll interpret it. That's what you're meaning. You'd like to find out about those investigating studies. All it commits you to do is to investigate. But who do you think Jesus is? In our survey, 45% of the people we asked said they believed that Jesus was God. I confess, I was astonished. For I do not see 45% of the community worshipping Jesus as God, or serving with Jesus as God, or living with Jesus as God. Nothing like it. And maybe that is your view. Maybe you've looked at the evidence and maybe you know that Jesus is who he claimed to be, the ruler of the world, the Christ, the Messiah, the judge of all men. If that is who he is, then what should we do? How should we respond to him? What is the appropriate response to one who is your maker, your ruler, your judge? It must be surely as he says, to deny yourself, take up your cross daily, follow him, to give your life to him is all that you can do. Insufficient as that is. It depends on who you think Jesus is. If you think he's a madman, well, you'll seek to lock him up or care for him. You'll seek to dispense him because he lived in another age. If that's who you think he is, I'd like to know your evidence for that view. For that is not what it seems to be. It seems to be singularly lacking that is anything mad about this one. Except his incredible claims, which keep on being backed up by other things. If you think he is the one who suffered for the world to bring us new life, and risen now rules the world and is going to judge the world, well then I'm no longer going to be king running my own life, my own way. I am answerable to him, and must give all to him.
those of you who have followed me this far, your natural response and feeling will be, I don't want to. That's the natural response for many of us. Some may be so sickened of life already that they're only too glad to find a new way. And I'll speak again to you in a few moments' time. But for many of us, life is full, life is happy. Warmth of clothes and house and shelter, food in our bellies. Why would I want to give up my life even while I am so young? Why would I want to do that? I mean, if I was to lay down my life for Jesus, what happens about my career? What happens if he wants me to drop it all and go off and become a missionary or something? Well, he may. He may do that. But I've worked so hard for it. Well, he may ask it. But what about my boyfriend, my girlfriend? Because I would go home and tell them that they don't want to have a bar of Christianity. They don't know I'm here. They don't want me to be here. I mean, I wouldn't want to destroy that relationship. Well, that tells us something about who your God is and who you're willing to worship. But I don't want to be unpopular. I don't want to suffer. I don't want to get to go into the office on Monday and say, hey, fellas, I became a Christian on the weekend. I know what they'll say. I know what they'll laugh and I'll know what they'll mock and they'll give me a terrible time for the next week or weeks or months or... I don't want to do that. In verses 24 to 26, Jesus actually answers that very feeling in our hearts of I don't want to, even though I know it's true, I don't want it. He says in 24 that if you save your life now, you will lose it. Whereas if you lose your life now, you will save it. There's the paradox of life. You can only actually, in the end, have life by giving it away. Strange thing, that isn't it? It's like love, too, isn't it? There's many things like that in life. You go seeking and searching for love, you never get it. You give up the search and start giving it to people and you find it all around you. Funny absurdity, a little paradox of life, that isn't it? Well, life is like it itself. You know you're going to lose life eventually, don't you? I know it's hard for us to ever grasp hold of. It's impossible to believe that I could be cut down now. But it's not really impossible, is it? Indeed, it's a certainty I will be eventually. If I care to hang on to my life now, says Jesus, and say, look, I'm not going to give up everything to Jesus. I'm going to keep doing the things I want to do. I'm going to keep living my way, my life, my style. You will lose it. And lose it forever. Whereas if you lose your life for my sake now, says Jesus, you will in the end save it. A similar argument is in verse 26. If you're ashamed of me now, then I'll be ashamed of you then. I don't want the ridicule, I don't want the unpopularity, I don't want the difficulty. There is ridicule, there is unpopularity, there is difficulty. I can look around and I know Christian friends here. I won't say who they are particularly, but I can point them out to you. I can get you to come and talk to them. I know the people who have lost jobs because they were Christians. I know the people whose families have been split up the middle because they've become Christians. I know the people who have lost very close friends because they've become Christians. It may not be like that for you, and I hope it's not. But it could be. One of our congregation members recently taught me that I should actually promise people when they become Christians that from there on in life will be interesting. It's a good word. I have a tendency to say it's going to be negative. It's not. God never takes from you without giving you far more. So then I have a tendency to say it's going to be tremendous. But then that's untrue because for some of us it's pretty rotten at times too. So the word's interesting. It's never the same again because you're no longer in control of it to do with it as you please anymore. Someone else is running the show now. And it becomes very interesting. Where he takes you. What happens. Where he leads. Where you go. Verse 25 gives a slightly different argument. And a famous one at that. What good is there to gain the whole world and forfeit yourself. What have you got? You say, look, I'm not going to give up my life. I just reached the prime of it. It's all the world's at my feet. I'm passing my exams. I'm about to enter into a career that is a sure, safe, secure future. I have a lovely girlfriend, lovely boyfriend. I've got health, I've got youth, I've got everything going for me. I'm not going to give it away now. Give it away to a man who lived 2,000 years ago, who I believe is God. I couldn't do that. I know it can be true, but it's too much. Well, what are you trading it for? What if you should actually succeed? You should actually gain the whole world. What have you got then? Houses, cars, pleasure. What have you got? Do I need to recount to you the tale of the unhappy millionaires? The suicides, the drugs of those poor creatures that we have forced into popularity through music or sport? Do I have to recount for you the sudden death of the wealthy? Poor man up the other day, wasn't a wealthy man I gathered, a man after being a barber for 50 years retired and the next day died. Up in Israel, wasn't it? How can you gather your wealth together in such a way that you will have life when you've forfeited it in getting it there? Do I now to recount to you the moral bankruptcy of success at the price of principles? That you give away your life like that? What have you got that is worth your soul? Let me bring it to a trivial example, but one which I'm sure will come home to some of you. My brother shared this with a high school friend many years ago, and the man said yes, he believed in Jesus, as many people do. And no, he wouldn't become a Christian, because he knew his girlfriend was implacably opposed to Christianity. And he wasn't going to miss out on her. And so he refused to become a Christian. 1 month later, she dropped him for another fellow. Classic, isn't it? It really is classic. It's almost predictable. If I'd paused too long, you could have worked it out. What God is there in this world that you're willing to deny the truth for? Because it doesn't matter what it is, it's a lie, isn't it? Because it's not God. It cannot last, it cannot satisfy, it cannot solve, it's a lie. Your career, your wealth, your status, yourself, what is it that is so important to you that even though you know that it be the truth, you wouldn't live by it because the cost is so much? Well then, what should I do if I know it to be the truth? If I'm one of that 45% who perceive Jesus, let me go through some of the alternatives before us now. There are some of us here who do not know about Jesus for certain. Very unsure of the evidence. In fact, we really don't know much at all. Can I encourage you about the bookstore? This book in particular, but there are other beaut ones up there. Can I encourage you about doing the investigative studies? But the actions I'm about to commend to people, can I encourage you not to take? Because it would be a phony, be a forgery. Won't help you. Find out the truth. Don't commit yourself to something that you don't really believe in. That's a nonsense step. Don't want anyone leaping off into the dark. Don't want to be responsible for it in any way at all. If that's where you're at, then the appropriate response for you is to find out more. And can I encourage you to do it? And offer the services of our congregation to help anybody who wishes to. But for those of you who know that Jesus is the Christ, and who wish to face up to that truth now in their lives, then in particular the next few moments are something that I want to share with you to help you. For what Jesus demands of you is to commit everything to him because of who he is. How do you do it? Over in the back of our outline, down on the bottom, there is a little prayer. It is the kind of prayer you'd need to pray if you are going to commit your life to Jesus, if you're going to deny yourself, take up your cross daily and follow him. I'm going to read it through now so that you can get familiar with what it's saying, and in a few moments' time I'll be praying it out loud for people. It goes, "Dear God, I know I'm not worthy to be called a child of God. I don't deserve your gift of eternal life. I'm guilty of rebelling against you and ignoring you, and I need forgiveness." That's a declaration of where I'm at. What's happening to me at the moment? That's my state. "Thank you for sending your son to die for me that I may be forgiven. Thank you that you raised Jesus to give me new life." Here is the gratitude for what Jesus has done, what God has done in Jesus. And then this is the request. "Please forgive me and change me that I may live with Jesus as my Lord and Master." So that last request is a total commitment, isn't it? I want God to pardon me for my past and to change me now, so that I may indeed live with you. The person who prays that kind of prayer, you don't have to use exactly those words, but the person who prays those sentiments, believing them in their heart, is the person who has taken the first step and has become a Christian. Remember, you take up the cross daily. That is just the first day of your new life. The first moment of your new life. But that is what a Christian is. Now before I pray that prayer, I want us to think about it. Very important step to take, isn't it? Some of us will be struggling with this for weeks and months and years. But when I'm talking 10 to the dozen, it's hard to give yourself time enough to think, does it? So I want us to do that.